Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is God's Gumshoe, and this is an investigation into the New Testament Bible. Today, we're continuing on with our investigation of the miracles of Jesus. This is the fifth and concluding episode of the miracles of Jesus, and we'll continue on today as we did in our last episode, with the biblical perspective first from the New Testament Bible, their explanation of the miracle and of the situation as it appears in the New Testament, and we'll follow that up with a reading from the Urantia Papers to see exactly how the papers and the New Testament merge these ideas into one complete whole. So I invite you to sit back and enjoy the miracles of Jesus, the concluding episode of the miracles of Jesus, and next week we'll move on to the parables. You won't want to miss that. Let's begin. Today we begin with a discussion of the miracle number 18, according to the Urantia Papers, and here we begin to understand that the New Testament has listed 35 miracles, whereas the Urantia Papers has 25, if you combine it with the number of people who were healed together, 28. And so there is a slight discrepancy. In any case, we're going to begin with miracle number 18, which is outlined in the New Testament in Matthew, chapter 15, verses 21 to 28, in which Matthew calls this the situation of the Canaanite woman and her daughter. In Mark 7, verses 24 to 30, she's called the Syrophoenician woman. And in the Urantia Papers, she's identified as the Syrian woman's daughter. In any case, this is the same miracle, the same situation with Jesus and this woman, as Jesus is traveling north into the area of Syria, Sidon, Tyre, in that area, and he's teaching and preaching and doing his good work, and he comes across this Gentile woman. Let's listen to the New Testament's version from Matthew and from Mark, and then we will listen to the Urantia Papers version from paper 156, section 1. Let's have a listen.
Chapter 78, Phoenician Woman's Daughter. Jesus found a house to enter so that he could escape the public eye. But his fame was too great, and it soon became known to the people in the area that Jesus was there. Almost immediately, a Canaanite-ish woman, whose daughter had an unclean spirit, having heard that Jesus was nearby, came and found him. She said to Jesus, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously tormented by a demon." But Jesus didn't say a word to her. The woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by race. The woman kept begging Jesus to cast the demon out of her daughter. Finally, the disciples came to Jesus and complained that she was making a nuisance out of herself and creating a disturbance everywhere they went. Jesus said to the disciples, "I was sent to the house of Israel." But the woman came and fell down at Jesus' feet and worshipped him, saying, "Lord, help me." Jesus answered and said to her, "Let the children first be filled, for it is not becoming to take the children's food and cast it to the dogs." But she answered and said to him, "Yes, Lord, but the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs, even while the children eat." Jesus said to her, "O woman, great is your faith. Let it be done to you as you wish. The demon has gone out of your daughter." And the woman returned home and found her daughter lying in bed, completely healed.
And now, from the Urantia Book, paper 156, section 1, the same story from the Urantia Book perspective.
Paper 156, The Sojourn at Tyre and Sidon. On Friday afternoon, June 10, Jesus and his associates arrived in the environs of Sidon, where they stopped at the home of a well-to-do woman who had been a patient in the Bethsaida Hospital during the times when Jesus was at the height of his popular favor. The evangelists and the apostles were lodged with her friends in the immediate neighborhood, and they rested over the Sabbath day amid these refreshing surroundings. They spent almost 2.5 weeks in Sidon and vicinity before they prepared to visit the coast cities to the north. This June Sabbath day was one of great quiet. The evangelists and apostles were together, absorbed in their meditations regarding the discourses of the Master on religion, to which they had listened en route to Sidon. They were all able to appreciate something of what he had told them, but none of them fully grasped the import of his teaching. 1. The Syrian Woman. There lived near the home of Karuska, where the Master lodged, a Syrian woman who had heard much of Jesus as a great healer and teacher, and on this Sabbath afternoon she came over bringing her little daughter. The child, about 12 years old, was afflicted with a grievous nervous disorder characterized by convulsions and other distressing manifestations. Jesus had charged his associates to tell no one of his presence at the home of Karuska, explaining that he desired to have a rest. While they had obeyed their master's instructions, the servant of Karuska had gone over to the house of this Syrian woman, Narana, to inform her that Jesus lodged at the home of her mistress, and had urged this anxious mother to bring her afflicted daughter for healing. This mother, of course, believed that her child was possessed of a demon, an unclean spirit. When Narana arrived with her daughter, the Alpheus twins explained through an interpreter that the master was resting and could not be disturbed, whereupon Narana replied that she and the child would remain right there until the master had finished his rest. Peter also endeavored to reason with her and to persuade her to go home. He explained that Jesus was weary with much teaching and healing, and that he had come to Phoenicia for a period of quiet and rest. But it was futile. Narana would not leave. To Peter's entreaty she replied only, "I will not depart until I have seen your master. I know he can cast the demon out of my child, and I will not go until the healer has looked upon my daughter." Then Thomas sought to send the woman away, but met only with failure. To him she said, "I have faith that your master can cast out this demon which torments my child. I have heard of his mighty works in Galilee, and I believe in him. What has happened to you, his disciples, that you would send away those who come seeking your master's help?" And when she had thus spoken, Thomas withdrew. Then came forward Simon Zelotes to remonstrate with Narana. Said Simon, "Woman, you are a Greek-speaking Gentile. It is not right that you should expect the master to take the bread intended for the children of the favored household and cast it to the dogs." But Narana refused to take offense at Simon's thrust. She replied only, "Yes, teacher, I understand your words. I am only a dog in the eyes of the Jews, but as concerns your master, I am a believing dog. I am determined that he shall see my daughter, for I am persuaded that, if he shall but look upon her, he will heal her. And even you, my good man, would not dare to deprive the dogs of the privilege of obtaining the crumbs which chance to fall from the children's table." At just this time the little girl was seized with a violent convulsion before them all, and the mother cried out, "There, you can see that my child is possessed by an evil spirit. If our need does not impress you, it would appeal to your master, who I have been told loves all men and dares even to heal the Gentiles when they believe. You are not worthy to be his disciples. I will not go until my child has been cured." Jesus, who had heard all of this conversation through an open window, now came outside, much to their surprise, and said, "O woman, great is your faith, so great that I cannot withhold that which you desire. Go your way in peace. Your daughter already has been made whole." And the little girl was well from that hour. As Narana and the child took leave, Jesus entreated them to tell no one of this occurrence, and while his associates did comply with this request, the mother and the child ceased not to proclaim the fact of the little girl's healing throughout all the countryside and even in Sidon, so much so that Jesus found it advisable to change his lodgings within a few days. The next day, as Jesus sought his apostles, commenting on the cure of the daughter of the Syrian woman, he said, "And so it has been all the way along. You see for yourselves how the Gentiles are able to exercise saving faith in the teachings of the gospel of the kingdom of heaven. Verily, verily, I tell you, that the Father's kingdom shall be taken by the Gentiles if the children of Abraham are not minded to show faith enough to enter therein."
So we see in this episode that Jesus wanted to honor the living faith of the Canaanite or the Syrian woman, and at the same time he wanted to teach his apostles a valuable lesson about the rights of the Gentiles to the privilege of the kingdom. that this was not just a Jewish thing, that he had come to bring the truth to both the Jew and the Gentile. Now we'll take a look at the 19th miracle called the epileptic boy. Matthew refers to it as a demonic situation. It was believed in those days that epileptics were invaded by demons. So this is in Matthew 17, chapter 17, verse 14 to 20, Mark 9, 14 to 29, and Luke 9, verses 37 to 43. We'll then follow this up with a reading from the Urantia Book, paper 158, sections 4 and 5. Here, the situation is that the year is 29 AD. They are at the base of Mount Hermon. Peter, James, and John have just come down from the mountain where they witnessed the transfiguration of Jesus. They are glowing. They are on fire. And they stumble into the camp, and here's what takes place.
Chapter 81E, Healing the Demoniac Boy. The very next day, after coming down off the mountain, Jesus saw a multitude of people. He saw that the scribes were questioning his disciples. When the multitude saw Jesus, they were amazed because his face was shining. And Jesus asked the multitude and his disciples, "What questions did the scribes ask?" And one of the men from the multitude came to Jesus and knelt before him and said, "Teacher, I have brought my son who has an evil spirit that keeps him from talking. He also has epilepsy and is suffering greatly. The evil spirit takes him and throws him down, and he gnashes his teeth and he foams at the mouth. He is badly bruised from all the abuse and full of sores. I brought the boy to your disciples, but they could not cast out the evil spirit." Jesus answered and said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long will I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring your son to me." And they brought the boy to Jesus, and when the boy saw Jesus, the demon threw him on the ground, and he began thrashing about, doing injury to himself and foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the father, "How long has your son been like this?" The father replied, "Since he was a young child. Sometimes the unclean spirit throws him into the fire, and sometimes he throws him into the water. If you can do anything for him, please have compassion on him and help us." And Jesus answered, "If I can, all things are possible to the one that believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out to Jesus, "I believe, please help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that people were running from everywhere to join the multitude, he rebuked the unclean spirit and said to him, "You deaf and dumb spirit, I command you to come out of him, and do not enter him again." The unclean spirit caused a great deal of torment as he obstinately came out of the boy. And the boy lay still on the ground as if he were dead. But Jesus took the boy by the hand and raised him up, and he was healed. And Jesus gave the boy to his father. And they were all astonished at the majesty of God. Afterwards, when Jesus went to the house where he was staying, his disciples came to him and asked him privately, "How come we could not cast out the unclean spirit?" And Jesus said to them, "Because of your little faith. Listen to this truth and pay attention. For if you had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you would say to this mountain, 'Move to another place,' and it will move. If you have faith, nothing will be impossible to you." And then he said to them, "This kind of demon can only come out with prayer."
Four, the epileptic boy. It was shortly before breakfast time on this Tuesday morning when Jesus and his companions arrived at the apostolic camp. As they drew near, they discerned a considerable crowd gathered around the apostles and soon began to hear the loud words of argument and disputation of this group of about 50 persons, embracing the 9 apostles, and a gathering equally divided between Jerusalem scribes and believing disciples who had tracked Jesus and his associates in their journey from Magadan. Although the crowd engaged in numerous arguments, the chief controversy was about a certain citizen of Tiberias who had arrived the preceding day in quest of Jesus. This man, James of Safed, had a son about 14 years old, an only child, who was severely afflicted with epilepsy. In addition to this nervous malady, this lad had become possessed by one of those wandering, mischievous, and rebellious midwayers who were then present on earth and uncontrolled, so that the youth was both epileptic and demon-possessed. For almost 2 weeks, this anxious father, a minor official of Herod Antipas, had wandered about through the western borders of Philip's domains, seeking Jesus that he might entreat him to cure his afflicted son. And he did not catch up with the apostolic party until about noon of this day, when Jesus was up on the mountain with the three apostles. The nine apostles were much surprised and considerably perturbed when this man, accompanied by almost 40 other persons who were looking for Jesus, suddenly came upon them. At the time of the arrival of this group, the nine apostles, at least the majority of them, had succumbed to their old temptation, that of discussing who should be the greatest in the coming kingdom. They were busily arguing about the probable positions which would be assigned the individual apostles. They simply could not free themselves entirely from the long-cherished idea of the material mission of the Messiah. And now that Jesus himself had accepted their confession that he was indeed the deliverer, at least he admitted the fact of his divinity, what was more natural than that, during this period of separation from the Master, they should fall to talking about those hopes and ambitions which were uppermost in their hearts? And they were engaged in these discussions when James of Safed and his fellow seekers after Jesus came upon them. Andrew stepped up to greet this father and his son, saying, "Whom do you seek?" Said James, "My good man, I search for your Master. I seek healing for my afflicted son. I would have Jesus cast out this devil that possesses my child." And then the father proceeded to relate to the apostles how his son was so afflicted that he had many times almost lost his life as a result of these malignant seizures. As the apostles listened, Simon Zelotes and Judas Iscariot stepped into the presence of the father, saying, "We can heal him. You need not wait for the Master's return. We are the ambassadors of the kingdom. No longer do we hold these things in secret. Jesus is the deliverer, and the keys of the kingdom have been delivered to us." By this time, Andrew and Thomas were in consultation at one side. Nathanael and the others looked on in amazement. They were all aghast at the sudden boldness, if not presumption, of Simon and Judas. Then said the father, "If it has been given you to do these works, I pray that you will speak those words which will deliver my child from this bondage." Then Simon stepped forward and, placing his hand on the head of the child, looked directly into his eyes and commanded, "Come out of him, you unclean spirit. In the name of Jesus, obey me." But the lad had only a more violent fit, while the scribes mocked the apostles in derision, and the disappointed believers suffered the taunts of these unfriendly critics. Andrew was deeply chagrined at this ill-advised effort and its dismal failure. He called the apostles aside for conference and prayer. After this season of meditation, feeling keenly the sting of their defeat and sensing the humiliation resting upon all of them, Andrew sought, in a second attempt, to cast out the demon, but only failure crowned his efforts. Andrew frankly confessed defeat and requested the father to remain with them overnight or until Jesus' return, saying, "Perhaps this sort goes not out except by the Master's personal command." And so, while Jesus was descending the mountain with the exuberant and ecstatic Peter, James, and John, their nine brethren likewise were sleepless in their confusion and downcast humiliation. They were a dejected and chastened group, but James of Safed would not give up. Although they could give him no idea as to when Jesus might return, he decided to stay on until the Master came back. 5. Jesus heals the boy. As Jesus drew near, the nine apostles were more than relieved to welcome him, and they were greatly encouraged to behold the good cheer and unusual enthusiasm which marked the countenances of Peter, James, and John. They all rushed forward to greet Jesus and their three brethren. As they exchanged greetings, the crowd came up, and Jesus asked, "What were you disputing about as we drew near?" But before the disconcerted and humiliated apostles could reply to the Master's question, the anxious father of the afflicted lad stepped forward and, kneeling at Jesus' feet, said, "Master, I have a son, an only child, who is possessed by an evil spirit. Not only does he cry out in terror, foam at the mouth, and fall like a dead person at the time of seizure, but oftentimes this evil spirit which possesses him rends him in convulsions, and sometimes has cast him into the water, and even into the fire. With much grinding of teeth, and as a result of many bruises, my child wastes away. His life is worse than death. His mother and I are of a sad heart and a broken spirit. About noon yesterday, seeking for you, I caught up with your disciples, and while we were waiting, your apostles sought to cast out this demon, but they could not do it. And now, Master, will you do this for us? Will you heal my son? When Jesus had listened to this recital, he touched the kneeling father and bade him rise while he gave the nearby apostles a searching survey. Then said Jesus to all those who stood before him, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I bear with you? How long shall I be with you? How long ere you learn that the works of faith come not forth at the bidding of doubting unbelief? And then, pointing to the bewildered father, Jesus said, Bring hither your son. And when James had brought the lad before Jesus, he asked, How long has the boy been afflicted in this way? The father answered, Since he was a very young child. And as they talked, the youth was seized with a violent attack and fell in their midst, gnashing his teeth and foaming at the mouth. After a succession of violent convulsions, he lay there before them as one dead. Now did the father again kneel at Jesus' feet, while he implored the master, saying, If you can cure him, I beseech you to have compassion on us and deliver us from this affliction. And when Jesus heard these words, he looked down into the father's anxious face, saying, Question not my father's power of love, only the sincerity and reach of your faith. All things are possible to him who really believes. And then James of Safed spoke those long-to-be-remembered words of commingled faith and doubt. Lord, I believe. I pray you help my unbelief. When Jesus heard these words, he stepped forward and, taking the lad by the hand, said, I will do this in accordance with my Father's will and in honor of living faith. My son, arise. Come out of him, disobedient spirit, and go not back into him. And placing the hand of the lad in the hand of the father, Jesus said, Go your way. The Father has granted the desire of your soul. And all who were present, even the enemies of Jesus, were astonished at what they saw. It was indeed a disillusionment for the three apostles who had so recently enjoyed the spiritual ecstasy of the scenes and experiences of the Transfiguration, so soon to return to the scene of the defeat and discomfiture of their fellow apostles. But it was ever so with these 12 ambassadors of the kingdom. They never failed to alternate between exaltation and humiliation in their life experiences. This was a true healing of a double affliction, a physical ailment and a spirit malady. And the lad was permanently cured from that hour. When James had departed with his restored son, Jesus said, We go now to Caesarea Philippi, make ready at once. And they were a quiet group as they journeyed southward, while the crowd followed on behind.
Here, as you may remember from an earlier episode, where we discussed the Midwayers as being those beings that are, the Urantia papers tell us, are halfway between an angel and a human, sort of, that there was a group that had rebelled and had left the kind of the official planetary government and were able to invade certain types of mind, not everyone, but certain types of mind. And here we have the situation of the epileptic boy being invaded and Jesus correcting this situation. These are all outlined in an earlier episode, and by all means go back and have a listen to that, and you will hear a little bit more about what the New Testament calls demons, and which in fact is just another name for dark angel. Now we'll proceed to the healing of the blind beggar. And here we have two situations that are outlined in the New Testament Bible, in John chapter 9. And in fact, John designates the whole of chapter 9 to this healing of the blind beggar that took place in Jerusalem. And miracle 25, which is the blind man at Jericho. Now, these are often confused in New Testament discussions as being the same type of miracle or the same miracle. But the Jerusalem one took place in AD 29 in Jerusalem, and the other took place in AD 30, just a few weeks before Jesus went to Jerusalem. This one took place in Jericho. So let us listen to the New Testament version, and then we'll listen to the Urantia papers. The New Testament version is John chapter 9, Matthew chapter 20, verses 29 to 34, Mark 10, verses 46 to 52, and Luke 18, verses 35 to 43. The Urantia paper discusses both of these miracles in paper 164, section 3, and paper 171, section 5. Let's hear about the blind beggars.
Once they landed on shore, Jesus and his disciples went to Bethsaida. This is not the Bethsaida that is the suburb of Capernaum, but Bethsaida Julius, which is a town on the east side of the Jordan River, near where it flows into the Sea of Galilee. A blind man was brought to Jesus for healing. Jesus took the blind man's hand and took him outside the village. Jesus then spit into his eye and laid his hand on his eyes and asked, "Do you see yet?" The man looked up and said, "I see men, but they look like walking trees." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and when the man opened his eyes, everything became perfectly clear.
Now here is the same version of that story from the Urantia paper, 164, section 3.
3. Healing the blind beggar. The next morning, the three went over to Martha's home at Bethany for breakfast, and then went immediately into Jerusalem. This Sabbath morning, as Jesus and his two apostles drew near the temple, they encountered a well-known beggar, a man who had been born blind, sitting at his usual place. Although these mendicants did not solicit or receive alms on the Sabbath day, they were permitted thus to sit in their usual places. Jesus paused and looked upon the beggar. As he gazed upon this man who had been born blind, the idea came into his mind as to how he would once more bring his mission on earth to the notice of the Sanhedrin and the other Jewish leaders and religious teachers. As the master stood there before the blind man, engrossed in deep thought, Nathanael, pondering the possible cause of this man's blindness, asked, "Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind?" The rabbis taught that all such cases of blindness from birth were caused by sin. Not only were children conceived and born in sin, but a child could be born blind as a punishment for some specific sin committed by its father. They even taught that a child itself might sin before it was born into the world. They also taught that such defects could be caused by some sin or other indulgence of the mother while carrying the child. There was, throughout all these regions, a lingering belief in reincarnation. The older Jewish teachers, together with Plato, Philo, and many of the Essenes, tolerated the theory that men may reap in one incarnation what they have sown in a previous existence. Thus, in one life, they were believed to be expiating the sins committed in preceding lives. The master found it difficult to make men believe that their souls had not had previous existences. However, inconsistent as it seems, while such blindness was supposed to be the result of sin, the Jews held that it was meritorious in a high degree to give alms to these blind beggars. It was the custom of these blind men constantly to chant to the passers-by, "O tender-hearted, gain merit by assisting the blind." Jesus entered into the discussion of this case with Nathanael and Thomas, not only because he had already decided to use this blind man as the means of that day bringing his mission once more prominently to the notice of the Jewish leaders, but also because he always encouraged his apostles to seek for the true causes of all phenomena, natural or spiritual. He had often warned them to avoid the common tendency to assign spiritual causes to commonplace physical events. Jesus decided to use this beggar in his plans for that day's work, but before doing anything for the blind man, Josiah by name, he proceeded to answer Nathanael's question. Said the master, "Neither did this man sin nor his parents, that the works of God might be manifest in him. This blindness has come upon him in the natural course of events, but we must now do the works of him who sent me, while it is still day, for the night will certainly come when it will be impossible to do the work we are about to perform. When I am in the world, I am the light of the world, but in only a little while I will not be with you." When Jesus had spoken, he said to Nathanael and Thomas, "Let us create the sight of this blind man on this Sabbath day, that the scribes and Pharisees may have the full occasion which they seek for accusing the Son of Man." Then, stooping over, he spat on the ground and mixed the clay with the spittle. And speaking of all this, so that the blind man could hear, he went up to Josiah and put the clay over his sightless eyes, saying, "Go, my son, wash away this clay in the pool of Siloam, and immediately you shall receive your sight." And when Josiah had so washed in the pool of Siloam, he returned to his friends and family, seeing. Having always been a beggar, he knew nothing else. So when the first excitement of the creation of his sight had passed, he returned to his usual place of alms-seeking. His friends, neighbors, and all who had known him aforetime, when they observed that he could see, all said, "Is this not Josiah the blind beggar?" Some said it was he, while others said, "No, it is one like him, but this man can see." And when they asked the man himself, he answered, "I am he." When they began to inquire of him how he was able to see, he answered them, "A man called Jesus came by this way, and when talking about me with his friends, he made clay with spittle, anointed my eyes, and directed that I should go and wash in the pool of Siloam. I did what this man told me, and immediately I received my sight. And that is only a few hours ago. I do not yet know the meaning of much that I see." And when the people who began to gather about him asked where they could find the strange man who had healed him, Josiah could answer only that he did not know. This is one of the strangest of all the Master's miracles. This man did not ask for healing. He did not know that the Jesus who had directed him to wash at Siloam and who had promised him vision was the prophet of Galilee who had preached in Jerusalem during the Feast of Tabernacles. This man had little faith that he would receive his sight, but the people of that day had great faith in the efficacy of the spittle of a great or holy man, and from Jesus' conversation with Nathanael and Thomas, Josiah had concluded that his would-be benefactor was a great man, a learned teacher, or a holy prophet. Accordingly, he did as Jesus directed him. Jesus made use of the clay and the spittle and directed him to wash in the symbolic pool of Siloam for three reasons. 1. This was not a miracle response to the individual's faith. This was a wonder which Jesus chose to perform for a purpose of his own, but which he so arranged that this man might derive lasting benefit therefrom. 2. As the blind man had not asked for healing, and since the faith he had was slight, these material acts were suggested for the purpose of encouraging him. He did believe in the superstition of the efficacy of spittle, and he knew the pool of Siloam was a semi-sacred place. But he would hardly have gone there had it not been necessary to wash away the clay of his anointing. There was just enough ceremony about the transaction to induce him to act. 3. But Jesus had a third reason for resorting to these material means in connection with this unique transaction. This was a miracle wrought purely in obedience to his own choosing, and thereby he desired to teach his followers of that day and all subsequent ages to refrain from despising or neglecting material means in the healing of the sick. He wanted to teach them that they must cease to regard miracles as the only method of curing human diseases. Jesus gave this man his sight by miraculous working on this Sabbath morning and in Jerusalem near the temple, for the prime purpose of making this act an open challenge to the Sanhedrin and all the Jewish teachers and religious leaders. This was his way of proclaiming an open break with the Pharisees. He was always positive in everything he did, and it was for the purpose of bringing these matters before the Sanhedrin that Jesus brought his two apostles to this man early in the afternoon of this Sabbath day, and deliberately provoked those discussions which compelled the Pharisees to take notice of the miracle.
And now, from paper 171, the healing of the blind beggar at Jericho.
5. The blind man at Jericho. Late on the afternoon of Thursday, March 30, Jesus and his apostles, at the head of a band of about 200 followers, approached the walls of Jericho. As they came near the gate of the city, they encountered a throng of beggars, among them one Bartimaeus, an elderly man who had been blind from his youth. This blind beggar had heard much about Jesus and knew all about his healing of the blind Josiah at Jerusalem. He had not known of Jesus' last visit to Jericho until he had gone on to Bethany. Bartimaeus had resolved that he would never again allow Jesus to visit Jericho without appealing to him for the restoration of his sight. News of Jesus' approach had been heralded throughout Jericho, and hundreds of the inhabitants flocked forth to meet him. When this great crowd came back escorting the Master into the city, Bartimaeus, hearing the heavy tramping of the multitude, knew that something unusual was happening, so he asked those standing near him what was going on. And one of the beggars replied, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." When Bartimaeus heard that Jesus was near, he lifted up his voice and began to cry aloud, "Jesus, Jesus, have mercy upon me." And as he continued to cry louder and louder, some of those near to Jesus went over and rebuked him, requesting him to hold his peace. But it was of no avail. He cried only the more and the louder. When Jesus heard the blind man crying out, he stood still. And when he saw him, he said to his friends, "Bring the man to me." And then they went over to Bartimaeus, saying, "Be of good cheer, come with us, for the master calls for you." When Bartimaeus heard these words, he threw aside his cloak, springing forward toward the center of the road, while those nearby guided him to Jesus. Addressing Bartimaeus, Jesus said, "What do you want me to do for you?" Then answered the blind man, "I would have my sight restored." And when Jesus heard this request and saw his faith, he said, "You shall receive your sight. Go your way. Your faith has made you whole." Immediately he received his sight, and he remained near Jesus, glorifying God, until the master started on the next day for Jerusalem. And then he went before the multitude, declaring to all how his sight had been restored in Jericho.
Now, let us investigate the miracle number 21, entitled The Ten Lepers. This is a well-known story in Luke 17, verses 11 to 19, and it refers to a time when Jesus and his apostles are in Perea, northern Perea actually, which is just across the Jordan River from Samaria, which in fact today we call Jordan. We'll listen to the New Testament version of this again, and then we'll listen to this opportunity that Jesus had and took to teach his apostles a lesson. The Ten Lepers. Let's have a listen.
Chapter 106, Ten Lepers. Later on, Jesus decided to return to Jerusalem. On his way, passing along the borders of Samaria and Galilee, he entered into a certain village where he was met by ten lepers. The lepers kept their distance from Jesus, but they did yell at him with a loud voice, saying, "Jesus, have mercy on us." When he saw them, he said to them, "Go and show yourselves to the priests." And they were all cleansed. One of the lepers, when he saw that he was healed, returned to Jesus and fell down on his face before him and gave him thanks and glorified God. He was a Samaritan. Jesus answered him and said, "Didn't I cleanse 10 of you? Where are the other 9? Why did they not return to give glory to God?" And Jesus said to the leper that had returned, "Go your way, your faith has made you whole."
And now the Urantia Papers version from paper 166, section 2.
2. The Ten Lepers. The next day, Jesus went with the 12 over to Emmaus near the border of Samaria, and as they approached the city, they encountered a group of 10 lepers who sojourned near this place. 9 of this group were Jews, 1 a Samaritan. Ordinarily, these Jews would have refrained from all association or contact with this Samaritan, but their common affliction was more than enough to overcome all religious prejudice. They had heard much of Jesus and his earlier miracles of healing, and since the 70 made a practice of announcing the time of Jesus' expected arrival when the master was out with the 12 on these tours, the 10 lepers had been made aware that he was expected to appear in this vicinity at about this time, and they were, accordingly, posted here on the outskirts of the city, where they hoped to attract his attention and ask for healing. When the lepers saw Jesus drawing near them, not daring to approach him, they stood afar off and cried to him, "Master, have mercy on us, cleanse us from our affliction. Heal us as you have healed others." Jesus had just been explaining to the 12 why the Gentiles of Perea, together with the less orthodox Jews, were more willing to believe the gospel preached by the 70 than were the more orthodox and tradition-bound Jews of Judea. He had called their attention to the fact that their message had likewise been more readily received by the Galileans and even by the Samaritans, but the 12 apostles were hardly yet willing to entertain kind feelings for the long-despised Samaritans. Accordingly, when Simon Zelotes observed the Samaritan among the lepers, he sought to induce the master to pass on into the city without even hesitating to exchange greetings with them. Said Jesus to Simon, "But what if the Samaritan loves God as well as the Jews? Should we sit in judgment on our fellow men? Who can tell? If we make these 10 men whole, perhaps the Samaritan will prove more grateful even than the Jews. Do you feel certain about your opinion, Simon?" And Simon quickly replied, "If you cleanse them, you will soon find out." And Jesus replied, "So shall it be, Simon, and you will soon know the truth regarding the gratitude of men and the loving mercy of God." Jesus, going near the lepers, said, If you would be made whole, go forthwith and show yourselves to the priests as required by the law of Moses. And as they went, they were made whole. But when the Samaritan saw that he was being healed, he turned back, and going in quest of Jesus, began to glorify God with a loud voice. And when he had found the Master, he fell on his knees at his feet, and gave thanks for his cleansing. The nine others, the Jews, had also discovered their healing, and while they were also grateful for their cleansing, they continued on their way to show themselves to the priests. As the Samaritan remained kneeling at Jesus' feet, the Master, looking about at the 12, especially at Simon Zelotes, said, "Were not 10 cleansed? Where then are the other 9, the Jews? Only one, this alien, has returned to give glory to God." And then he said to the Samaritan, "Arise and go your way. Your faith has made you whole." Jesus looked again at his apostles as the stranger departed. And the apostles all looked at Jesus, save Simon Zelotes, whose eyes were downcast. The 12 said not a word, neither did Jesus speak. It was not necessary that he should. Though all 10 of these men really believed they had leprosy, only 4 were thus afflicted. The other 6 were cured of a skin disease, which had been mistaken for leprosy. But the Samaritan really had leprosy. Jesus enjoined the 12 to say nothing about the cleansing of the lepers, and as they went on into Emmaus, he remarked, "You see how it is that the children of the house, even when they are insubordinate to their father's will, take their blessings for granted. They think it a small matter if they neglect to give thanks when the father bestows healing upon them, but the strangers, when they receive gifts from the head of the house, are filled with wonder, and are constrained to give thanks in recognition of the good things bestowed upon them." And still the apostles said nothing in reply to the Master's words.
Now, let's have a listen to the situation that happened in Philadelphia in and around A.D. 30, called the healing of the dropsical man. This, in particular, tells us of the situation of Jesus and his apostles as they are moving in and around the Middle East area, in Sumeria, Perea, Galilee, and Judea. From paper 167, section 1, here is a real good picture of their activities as they take place in the year A.D. 30.
Paper 167, The Visit to Philadelphia. Throughout this period of the Perean ministry, when mention is made of Jesus and the apostles visiting the various localities where the 70 were at work, it should be recalled that, as a rule, only 10 were with him, since it was the practice to leave at least 2 of the apostles at Pella to instruct the multitude. As Jesus prepared to go on to Philadelphia, Simon Peter and his brother Andrew returned to the Pella encampment to teach the crowds there assembled. When the Master left the camp at Pella to visit about Perea, it was not uncommon for from 300 to 500 of the campers to follow him. When he arrived at Philadelphia, he was accompanied by over 600 followers. No miracles had attended the recent preaching tour through the Decapolis, and, excepting the cleansing of the 10 lepers, thus far there had been no miracles on this Perean mission. This was a period when the gospel was proclaimed with power, without miracles, and most of the time without the personal presence of Jesus or even of his apostles. Jesus and the 10 apostles arrived at Philadelphia on Wednesday, February 22, and spent Thursday and Friday resting from their recent travels and labors. That Friday night, James spoke in the synagogue, and a general council was called for the following evening. They were much rejoiced over the progress of the gospel at Philadelphia and among the nearby villages. The messengers of David also brought word of the further advancement of the kingdom throughout Palestine, as well as good news from Alexandria and Damascus. 1. Breakfast with the Pharisees. There lived in Philadelphia a very wealthy and influential Pharisee who had accepted the teachings of Abner, and who invited Jesus to his house Sabbath morning for breakfast. It was known that Jesus was expected in Philadelphia at this time, so a large number of visitors, among them many Pharisees, had come over from Jerusalem and from elsewhere. Accordingly, about 40 of these leading men and a few lawyers were bidden to this breakfast, which had been arranged in honor of the Master. As Jesus lingered by the door, speaking with Abner, and after the host had seated himself, there came into the room one of the leading Pharisees of Jerusalem, a member of the Sanhedrin, and, as was his habit, he made straight for the seat of honor at the left of the host. But since this place had been reserved for the master, and that on the right for Abner, the host beckoned the Jerusalem Pharisee to sit four seats to the left, and this dignitary was much offended because he did not receive the seat of honor. Soon they were all seated and enjoying the visiting among themselves, since the majority of those present were disciples of Jesus, or else were friendly to the gospel. Only his enemies took notice of the fact that he did not observe the ceremonial washing of his hands before he sat down to eat. Abner washed his hands at the beginning of the meal, but not during the serving. Near the end of the meal there came in from the street a man long afflicted with a chronic disease and now in a dropsical condition. This man was a believer, having recently been baptized by Abner's associates. He made no request of Jesus for healing, but the master knew full well that this afflicted man came to this breakfast hoping thereby to escape the crowds which thronged him and thus be more likely to engage his attention. This man knew that few miracles were then being performed. However, he had reasoned in his heart that his sorry plight might possibly appeal to the master's compassion. And he was not mistaken, for when he entered the room, both Jesus and the self-righteous Pharisee from Jerusalem took notice of him. The Pharisee was not slow to voice his resentment that such a one should be permitted to enter the room. But Jesus looked upon the sick man and smiled so benignly that he drew near and sat down upon the floor. As the meal was ending, the master looked over his fellow guests and then, after glancing significantly at the man with dropsy, said, "My friends, teachers in Israel, and learned lawyers, I would like to ask you a question. Is it lawful to heal the sick and afflicted on the Sabbath day, or not?" But those who were there present knew Jesus too well. They held their peace. They answered not his question. Then went Jesus over to where the sick man sat, and, taking him by the hand, said, "Arise, and go your way. You have not asked to be healed, but I know the desire of your heart and the faith of your soul." Before the man left the room, Jesus returned to his seat and, addressing those at the table, said, "Such works my Father does, not to tempt you into the kingdom, but to reveal himself to those who are already in the kingdom. You can perceive that it would be like the Father to do just such things, because which one of you, having a favorite animal that fell in the well on the Sabbath day, would not go right out and draw him up?" And since no one would answer him, and inasmuch as his host evidently approved of what was going on, Jesus stood up and spoke to all present. "My brethren, when you are bidden to a marriage feast, sit not down in the chief seat, lest perchance a more honored man than you has been invited, and the host will have to come to you and request that you give your place to this other and honored guest. In this event, with shame you will be required to take a lower place at the table. When you are bidden to a feast, it would be the part of wisdom, on arriving at the festive table, to seek for the lowest place and take your seat therein, so that, when the host looks over the guests, he may say to you, 'My friend, why sit in the seat of the least? Come up higher.' And thus will such a one have glory in the presence of his fellow guests. Forget not, every one who exalts himself shall be humbled, while he who truly humbles himself shall be exalted. Therefore, when you entertain at dinner or give a supper, invite not always your friends, your brethren, your kinsmen, or your rich neighbors, that they in return may bid you to their feasts, and thus will you be recompensed. When you give a banquet, sometimes bid the poor, the maimed, and the blind. In this way you shall be blessed in your heart, for you well know that the lame and the halt cannot repay you for your loving ministry." 2. Parable of the Great Supper. As Jesus finished speaking at the breakfast table of the Pharisee, one of the lawyers present, desiring to relieve the silence, thoughtlessly said, "Blessed is he who shall eat bread in the kingdom of God," that being a common saying of those days. And then Jesus spoke a parable, which even his friendly host was compelled to take to heart. He said, "A certain ruler gave a great supper, and having bidden many guests, he dispatched his servants at supper time to say to those who were invited, 'Come, for everything is now ready.' And they all with one accord began to make excuses. The first said, I have just bought a farm, and I must needs go to prove it. I pray you have me excused. Another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I must go to receive them. I pray you have me excused. And another said, I have just married a wife, and therefore I cannot come. So the servants went back and reported this to their master. When the master of the house heard this, he was very angry, and turning to his servants, he said, I have made ready this marriage feast, the fatlings are killed, and all is in readiness for my guests, but they have spurned my invitation. They have gone every man after his lands and his merchandise, and they even show disrespect to my servants who bid them come to my feast. Go out quickly, therefore, into the streets and lanes of the city, out into the highways and the byways, and bring hither the poor and the outcast, the blind and the lame, that the marriage feast may have guests. And the servants did as their lord commanded, and even then there was room for more guests. Then said the lord to his servants, Go now out into the roads and the countryside, and constrain those who are there to come in that my house may be filled. I declare that none of those who were first bidden shall taste of my supper. And the servants did as their master commanded, and the house was filled. And when they heard these words, they departed. Every man went to his own place. At least one of the sneering Pharisees present that morning comprehended the meaning of this parable, for he was baptized that day and made public confession of his faith in the gospel of the kingdom. Abner preached on this parable that night at the general council of believers. The next day, all of the apostles engaged in the philosophic exercise of endeavoring to interpret the meaning of this parable of the Great Supper. Though Jesus listened with interest to all of these differing interpretations, he steadfastly refused to offer them further help in understanding the parable. He would only say, Let every man find out the meaning for himself and in his own soul.
Now, from Luke 13, verses 10 to 21, we read in the New Testament about Jesus healing on the Sabbath quite a few times. This refers to the woman with the spirit of infirmity. Happened in A.D. 30 at a Philadelphia synagogue. Here from Luke 13 is the New Testament reference, and then from paper 167, the Urantia paper version.
Chapter 98, Woman Healed on the Sabbath. Jesus was teaching in the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and there was a woman who had been suffering for 18 years from a spirit of infirmity that left her twisted so that she could not even stand up straight. Jesus saw the woman, called her over and said, Woman, you are set free from your infirmity. He laid hands on her and she was immediately cured. She was able to stand up straight and she began glorifying God. The ruler of the synagogue became indignant at Jesus because he had healed on the Sabbath day. And the ruler said to the multitude, There are 6 days in which to do your work, and you can be healed on any one of those days, but not on the Sabbath. The Lord answered him and said, You hypocrites! Doesn't each of you lead your ox or your donkey to water on the Sabbath? And shouldn't this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound for 18 years, be freed from her bondage on the day of the Sabbath? As Jesus said these things, his adversaries were put to shame, and all the multitude rejoiced because of all the glorious things that Jesus did.
3. The woman with the spirit of infirmity. Abner had arranged for the master to teach in the synagogue on this Sabbath day, the first time Jesus had appeared in a synagogue, since they had all been closed to his teachings by order of the Sanhedrin. At the conclusion of the service, Jesus looked down before him upon an elderly woman who wore a downcast expression and who was much bent in form. This woman had long been fear-ridden, and all joy had passed out of her life. As Jesus stepped down from the pulpit, he went over to her and, touching her bowed-over form on the shoulder, said, Woman, if you would only believe, you could be wholly loosed from your spirit of infirmity. And this woman, who had been bowed down and bound up by the depressions of fear for more than 18 years, believed the words of the Master, and by faith straightened up immediately. When this woman saw that she had been made straight, she lifted up her voice and glorified God. Notwithstanding that this woman's affliction was wholly mental, her bowed-over form being the result of her depressed mind, the people thought that Jesus had healed a real physical disorder. Although the congregation of the synagogue at Philadelphia was friendly toward the teachings of Jesus, the chief ruler of the synagogue was an unfriendly Pharisee. And as he shared the opinion of the congregation that Jesus had healed a physical disorder, and being indignant because Jesus had presumed to do such a thing on the Sabbath, he stood up before the congregation and said, "Are there not 6 days in which men should do all their work? In these working days come, therefore, and be healed, but not on the Sabbath day." When the unfriendly ruler had thus spoken, Jesus returned to the speaker's platform and said, "Why play the part of hypocrites? Does not every one of you, on the Sabbath, loose his ox from the stall and lead him forth for watering? If such a service is permissible on the Sabbath day, should not this woman, a daughter of Abraham who has been bound down by evil these 18 years, be loosed from this bondage and led forth to partake of the waters of liberty and life even on this Sabbath day?" And as the woman continued to glorify God, his critic was put to shame, and the congregation rejoiced with her that she had been healed. As a result of his public criticism of Jesus on this Sabbath, the chief ruler of the synagogue was deposed, and a follower of Jesus was put in his place. Jesus frequently delivered such victims of fear from their spirit of infirmity, from their depression of mind, and from their bondage of fear. But the people thought that all such afflictions were either physical disorders or possession of evil spirits. Jesus taught again in the synagogue on Sunday, and many were baptized by Abner at noon on that day, in the river which flowed south of the city. On the morrow, Jesus and the 10 apostles would have started back to the Pella encampment, but for the arrival of one of David's messengers, who brought an urgent message to Jesus from his friends at Bethany, near Jerusalem.
Now let's discuss the miracle of miracles, the resurrection of Lazarus. Here, this takes place in AD 30 in Bethany, where Jesus, in a last attempt to win the Jewish rulers over in their own terms of miraculous wonders and even the resurrection of the dead, which many of them believed, he performs this miracle as a gesture of personal friendship to his friend Lazarus, who was part of the Bethany family, who along with the Zebedees were probably his best friends in a family sense than any others on earth. He'd been teaching eternal life, and now he was prepared to demonstrate it. Also, he wanted to help his apostles to understand the promise of his own resurrection. And so here we have the New Testament version of the raising of Lazarus, which is outlined in John 11, verses 38 to 46, and then in the Urantia Papers, paper 168, sections introduction, or 0, to section 5. Let's have a listen to the resurrection of Lazarus.
Chapter 104, Raising of Lazarus. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, in the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who had anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair. Mary and Martha sent word to Jesus that their brother Lazarus, who Jesus loved, was sick to the point of death. When Jesus heard it, he said, "This sickness has come about so that God and his Son will be glorified." Jesus loved Mary and Martha and their brother Lazarus. Jesus stayed 2 more days where he was. Then after 2 days, he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." The disciples said to him, "Master, the Jews that live in that region are wanting to stone you, and you want to go back there?" Jesus answered, "There are not 12 hours in the day. If a man walk in the light, he doesn't stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if a man walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." Jesus said these things to his disciples after he told them that their friend Lazarus had fallen asleep. "I will go and wake him up." His disciples said, "If he is asleep, then perhaps the fever is gone." Jesus was saying that Lazarus was dead, but the disciples thought he was saying that Lazarus was finally restfully sleeping. Finally, Jesus said to his disciples, "Lazarus is dead, and I was glad for your sakes that I was not there, so that you may believe. Let's go to him." Thomas, who is also called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, "Let's go so that we can die with him." So when Jesus came to Bethany, to the house of Mary and Martha, he found that Lazarus had been in the tomb for 4 days already. Now Bethany was less than a mile from Jerusalem. Many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them over the death of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him, but Mary stayed in her home. Martha said to Jesus, "If you had been here, Lord, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that what you ask God, he will do." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes on me, even if he dies, yet he will live. And whoever lives and believes on me will never die. Do you believe this?" Martha said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the one sent to this world from God." And after she said this, she went her way and called Mary her sister secretly, saying, "The teacher is here and looking for you." Mary got up quickly and went to Jesus. Jesus was still not in Bethany, but waiting at the same place that Martha had left him. The Jews that were in Mary and Martha's house and were consoling them, when they saw Mary get up quickly and leave, they supposed that she was going to the tomb to weep. When Mary came to where Jesus was, she fell at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews also who had come along with her weeping, he groaned in his spirit and was troubled and asked, "Where have you laid him?" They said, "Lord, come see." Jesus wept. The Jews said, "Look at how he loved him." But others said, "If he could open the eyes of the blind, couldn't he have prevented Lazarus from dying?" After groaning, Jesus came up to the tomb that was in the cave with the stone laying against the opening. "Lord, the body is decayed since it's been dead for 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Didn't I tell you that if you believed, you should see the glory of God?" So at Jesus' instruction, they took away the stone from in front of the tomb. Jesus lifted his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you hear me. I know you always hear me, but I want the people who are here to believe that you sent me." And then Jesus said with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Out of the tomb came Lazarus. His hands and feet were bound with grave clothes, and his face was covered by a napkin. Jesus said to them, "Unwrap him and let him go." Many of the Jews who had come to comfort Mary and her sister Martha saw Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead, and they believed in him. Others went out and told the Pharisees what Jesus had done.
Four, the message from Bethany. Very late on Sunday night, February 26, a runner from Bethany arrived at Philadelphia, bringing a message from Martha and Mary, which said, "Lord, he whom you love is very sick." This message reached Jesus at the close of the evening conference and just as he was taking leave of the apostles for the night. At first, Jesus made no reply. There occurred one of those strange interludes, a time when he appeared to be in communication with something outside of and beyond himself. And then, looking up, he addressed the messenger in the hearing of the apostles, saying, "This sickness is really not to the death. Doubt not that it may be used to glorify God and exalt the Son." Jesus was very fond of Martha, Mary, and their brother Lazarus. He loved them with a fervent affection. His first and human thought was to go to their assistance at once, but another idea came into his combined mind. He had almost given up hope that the Jewish leaders at Jerusalem would ever accept the kingdom, but he still loved his people, and there now occurred to him a plan whereby the scribes and Pharisees of Jerusalem might have one more chance to accept his teachings, and he decided, his father willing, to make this last appeal to Jerusalem the most profound and stupendous outward working of his entire earth career. The Jews clung to the idea of a wonder-working deliverer, and though he refused to stoop to the performance of material wonders or to the enactment of temporal exhibitions of political power, he did now ask the Father's consent for the manifestation of his hitherto unexhibited power over life and death. The Jews were in the habit of burying their dead on the day of their demise. This was a necessary practice in such a warm climate. It often happened that they put in the tomb one who was merely comatose, so that on the second or even the third day such a one would come forth from the tomb. But it was the belief of the Jews that, while the spirit or soul might linger near the body for 2 or 3 days, it never tarried after the third day, that decay was well advanced by the fourth day, and that no one ever returned from the tomb after the lapse of such a period. And it was for these reasons that Jesus tarried yet 2 full days in Philadelphia before he made ready to start for Bethany. Accordingly, early on Wednesday morning he said to his apostles, "Let us prepare at once to go into Judea again." And when the apostles heard their master say this, they drew off by themselves for a time to take counsel of one another. James assumed the direction of the conference, and they all agreed that it was only folly to allow Jesus to go again into Judea, and they came back as one man and so informed him. Said James, "Master, you were in Jerusalem a few weeks back, and the leaders sought your death, while the people were minded to stone you. At that time you gave these men their chance to receive the truth, and we will not permit you to go again into Judea." Then said Jesus, "But do you not understand that there are 12 hours of the day in which work may safely be done? If a man walks in the day, he does not stumble, inasmuch as he has light. If a man walks in the night, he is liable to stumble, since he is without light. As long as my day lasts, I fear not to enter Judea. I would do one more mighty work for these Jews. I would give them one more chance to believe, even on their own terms. Conditions of outward glory and the visible manifestation of the power of the Father and the love of the Son. Besides, do you not realize that our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, and I would go to awaken him out of this sleep?" Then said one of the apostles, "Master, if Lazarus has fallen asleep, then he will the more surely recover." It was the custom of the Jews at that time to speak of death as a form of sleep. But as the apostles did not understand that Jesus meant that Lazarus had departed from this world, he now said plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes, even if the others are not thereby saved, that I was not there, to the end that you shall now have new cause to believe in me, and by that which you will witness, you should all be strengthened in preparation for that day when I shall take leave of you and go to the Father." When they could not persuade him to refrain from going into Judea, and when some of the apostles were loath even to accompany him, Thomas addressed his fellows, saying, "We have told the Master our fears, but he is determined to go to Bethany. I am satisfied it means the end. They will surely kill him. But if that is the Master's choice, then let us acquit ourselves like men of courage. Let us go also, that we may die with him." And it was ever so, in matters requiring deliberate and sustained courage, Thomas was always the mainstay of the 12 apostles. Paper 168, The Resurrection of Lazarus. It was shortly after noon when Martha started out to meet Jesus as he came over the brow of the hill near Bethany. Her brother Lazarus had been dead 4 days and had been laid away in their private tomb at the far end of the garden late on Sunday afternoon. The stone at the entrance of the tomb had been rolled in place on the morning of this day, Thursday. When Martha and Mary sent word to Jesus concerning Lazarus' illness, they were confident the Master would do something about it. They knew that their brother was desperately sick, and though they hardly dared hope that Jesus would leave his work of teaching and preaching to come to their assistance, they had such confidence in his power to heal disease that they thought he would just speak the curative words and Lazarus would immediately be made whole. And when Lazarus died a few hours after the messenger left Bethany for Philadelphia, they reasoned that it was because the Master did not learn of their brother's illness until it was too late, until he had already been dead for several hours. But they, with all of their believing friends, were greatly puzzled by the message which the runner brought back Tuesday forenoon when he reached Bethany. The messenger insisted that he heard Jesus say, "This sickness is really not to the death." Neither could they understand why he sent no word to them, nor otherwise proffered assistance. Many friends from nearby hamlets and others from Jerusalem came over to comfort the sorrow-stricken sisters. Lazarus and his sisters were the children of a well-to-do and honorable Jew, one who had been the leading resident of the little village of Bethany. And notwithstanding that all three had long been ardent followers of Jesus, they were highly respected by all who knew them. They had inherited extensive vineyards and olive orchards in this vicinity, and that they were wealthy was further attested by the fact that they could afford a private burial tomb on their own premises. Both of their parents had already been laid away in this tomb. Mary had given up the thought of Jesus' coming and was abandoned to her grief. But Martha clung to the hope that Jesus would come, even up to the time on that very morning when they rolled the stone in front of the tomb and sealed the entrance. Even then she instructed a neighbor lad to keep watch down the Jericho road from the brow of the hill to the east of Bethany, and it was this lad who brought tidings to Martha that Jesus and his friends were approaching. When Martha met Jesus, she fell at his feet, exclaiming, "Master, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Many fears were passing through Martha's mind, but she gave expression to no doubt, nor did she venture to criticize or question the Master's conduct as related to Lazarus' death. When she had spoken, Jesus reached down and, lifting her upon her feet, said, "Only have faith, Martha, and your brother shall rise again." Then answered Martha, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection of the last day, and even now I believe that whatever you shall ask of God, our Father will give you." Then said Jesus, looking straight into the eyes of Martha, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he dies, yet shall live. In truth, whosoever lives and believes in me shall never really die. Martha, do you believe this?" And Martha answered the Master, "Yes, I have long believed that you are the Deliverer, the Son of the living God, even he who should come to this world." Jesus having inquired for Mary, Martha went at once into the house and, whispering to her sister, said, "The Master is here and has asked for you." And when Mary heard this, she rose up quickly and hastened out to meet Jesus, who still tarried at the place, some distance from the house, where Martha had first met him. The friends who were with Mary, seeking to comfort her, when they saw that she rose up quickly and went out, followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep. Many of those present were Jesus' bitter enemies. That is why Martha had come out to meet him alone, and also why she went in secretly to inform Mary that he had asked for her. Martha, while craving to see Jesus, desired to avoid any possible unpleasantness which might be caused by his coming suddenly into the midst of a large group of his Jerusalem enemies. It had been Martha's intention to remain in the house with their friends while Mary went to greet Jesus. But in this she failed, for they all followed Mary and so found themselves, unexpectedly, in the presence of the Master. Martha led Mary to Jesus, and when she saw him, she fell at his feet, exclaiming, "If you had only been here, my brother would not have died." And when Jesus saw how they all grieved over the death of Lazarus, his soul was moved with compassion. When the mourners saw that Mary had gone to greet Jesus, they withdrew for a short distance while both Martha and Mary talked with the Master and received further words of comfort and exhortation to maintain strong faith in the Father and complete resignation to the divine will. The human mind of Jesus was mightily moved by the contention between his love for Lazarus and the bereaved sisters, and his disdain and contempt for the outward show of affection manifested by some of these unbelieving and murderously intentioned Jews. Jesus indignantly resented the show of forced and outward mourning for Lazarus by some of these professed friends, inasmuch as such false sorrow was associated in their hearts with so much bitter enmity toward himself. Some of these Jews, however, were sincere in their mourning, for they were real friends of the family. 1. At the tomb of Lazarus. After Jesus had spent a few moments in comforting Martha and Mary, apart from the mourners, he asked them, "Where have you laid him?" Then Martha said, "Come and see." And as the Master followed on in silence with the two sorrowing sisters, he wept. When the friendly Jews who followed after them saw his tears, one of them said, "Behold how he loved him. Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind have kept this man from dying?" By this time they were standing before the family tomb, a small natural cave or declivity in the ledge of rock which rose up some 30 feet at the far end of the garden plot. It is difficult to explain to human minds just why Jesus wept. While we have access to the registration of the combined human emotions and divine thoughts, as of record in the mind of the personalized adjuster, we are not altogether certain about the real cause of these emotional manifestations. We are inclined to believe that Jesus wept because of a number of thoughts and feelings which were going through his mind at this time, such as 1. He felt a genuine and sorrowful sympathy for Martha and Mary. He had a real and deep human affection for these sisters who had lost their brother. 2. He was perturbed in his mind by the presence of the crowd of mourners, some sincere and some merely pretenders. He always resented these outward exhibitions of mourning. He knew the sisters loved their brother and had faith in the survival of believers. These conflicting emotions may possibly explain why he groaned as they came near the tomb. 3. He truly hesitated about bringing Lazarus back to the mortal life. His sisters really needed him, but Jesus regretted having to summon his friend back to experience the bitter persecution which he well knew Lazarus would have to endure as a result of being the subject of the greatest of all demonstrations of the divine power of the Son of Man. And now we may relate an interesting and instructive fact. Although this narrative unfolds as an apparently natural and normal event in human affairs, it has some very interesting sidelights. While the messenger went to Jesus on Sunday, telling him of Lazarus' illness, and while Jesus sent word that it was not to the death, at the same time he went in person up to Bethany and even asked the sisters, "Where have you laid him?" Even though all of this seems to indicate that the Master was proceeding after the manner of his life and in accordance with the limited knowledge of the human mind, nevertheless, the records of the universe reveal that Jesus' personalized adjuster issued orders for the indefinite detention of Lazarus' thought adjuster on the planet subsequent to Lazarus' death, and that this order was made of record just 15 minutes before Lazarus breathed his last. Did the divine mind of Jesus know, even before Lazarus died, that he would raise him from the dead? We do not know. We know only what we are herewith placing on record. Many of Jesus' enemies were inclined to sneer at his manifestations of affection, and they said among themselves, "If he thought so much of this man, why did he tarry so long before coming to Bethany? If he is what they claim, why did he not save his dear friend? What is the good of healing strangers in Galilee if he cannot save those whom he loves?" And in many other ways they mocked and made light of the teachings and works of Jesus. And so on this Thursday afternoon at about 2:30 was the stage all set in this little hamlet of Bethany for the enactment of the greatest of all works connected with the earth ministry of Michael of Nebaton, the greatest manifestation of divine power during his incarnation in the flesh, since his own resurrection occurred after he had been liberated from the bonds of mortal habitation. The small group assembled before Lazarus' tomb little realized the presence near at hand of a vast concourse of all orders of celestial beings assembled under the leadership of Gabriel and now in waiting, by direction of the personalized adjuster of Jesus, vibrating with expectancy and ready to execute the bidding of their beloved sovereign. When Jesus spoke those words of command, "Take away the stone," the assembled celestial hosts made ready to enact the drama of the resurrection of Lazarus in the likeness of his mortal flesh. Such a form of resurrection involves difficulties of execution which far transcend the usual technique of the resurrection of mortal creatures in Maranatha form, and requires far more celestial personalities and a far greater organization of universe facilities. When Martha and Mary heard this command of Jesus directing that the stone in front of the tomb be rolled away, they were filled with conflicting emotions. Mary hoped that Lazarus was to be raised from the dead, but Martha, while to some extent sharing her sister's faith, was more exercised by the fear that Lazarus would not be presentable in his appearance to Jesus, the apostles, and their friends. Said Martha, "Must we roll away the stone? My brother has now been dead 4 days, so that by this time decay of the body has begun." Martha also said this because she was not certain as to why the Master had requested that the stone be removed. She thought maybe Jesus wanted only to take one last look at Lazarus. She was not settled and constant in her attitude. As they hesitated to roll away the stone, Jesus said, "Did I not tell you at the first that this sickness was not to the death? Have I not come to fulfill my promise? And after I came to you, did I not say that, if you would only believe, you should see the glory of God? Wherefore do you doubt? How long before you will believe and obey?" When Jesus had finished speaking, his apostles, with the assistance of willing neighbors, laid hold upon the stone and rolled it away from the entrance to the tomb. It was the common belief of the Jews that the drop of gall on the point of the sword of the angel of death had begun to work by the end of the third day, so that it was taking full effect on the fourth day. They allowed that the soul of man might linger about the tomb until the end of the third day, seeking to reanimate the dead body. But they firmly believed that such a soul had gone on to the abode of departed spirits ere the fourth day had dawned. These beliefs and opinions regarding the dead and the departure of the spirits of the dead served to make sure, in the minds of all who were now present at Lazarus's tomb, and subsequently to all who might hear of what was about to occur, that this was really and truly a case of the raising of the dead by the personal working of one who declared he was the resurrection and the life. 2. The resurrection of Lazarus. As this company of some 45 mortals stood before the tomb, they could dimly see the form of Lazarus, wrapped in linen bandages, resting on the right lower niche of the burial cave. While these earth creatures stood there in almost breathless silence, a vast host of celestial beings had swung into their places preparatory to answering the signal for action when it should be given by Gabriel, their commander. Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I am thankful that you have heard and granted my request. I know that you always hear me, but because of those who stand here with me, I thus speak with you, that they may believe that you have sent me into the world, and that they may know that you are working with me in that which we are about to do." And when he had prayed, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Though these human observers remained motionless, the vast celestial host was all astir in unified action in obedience to the Creator's word. In just 12 seconds of earth time, the hitherto lifeless form of Lazarus began to move, and presently sat up on the edge of the stone shelf whereon it had rested. His body was bound about with grave cloths, and his face was covered with a napkin. And as he stood up before them, alive, Jesus said, "Loose him, and let him go." All, save the apostles with Martha and Mary, fled to the house. They were pale with fright, and overcome with astonishment. While some tarried, many hastened to their homes. Lazarus greeted Jesus and the apostles, and asked the meaning of the grave cause and why he had awakened in the garden. Jesus and the apostles drew to one side while Martha told Lazarus of his death, burial, and resurrection. She had to explain to him that he had died on Sunday and was now brought back to life on Thursday, inasmuch as he had no consciousness of time since falling asleep in death. As Lazarus came out of the tomb, the personalized adjuster of Jesus, now chief of his kind in this local universe, gave command to the former adjuster of Lazarus, now in waiting, to resume abode in the mind and soul of the resurrected man. Then went Lazarus over to Jesus and, with his sisters, knelt at the Master's feet to give thanks and offer praise to God. Jesus, taking Lazarus by the hand, lifted him up, saying, "My son, what has happened to you will also be experienced by all who believe this gospel, except that they shall be resurrected in a more glorious form. You shall be a living witness of the truth which I spoke. I am the resurrection and the life. But let us all now go into the house and partake of nourishment for these physical bodies." As they walked toward the house, Gabriel dismissed the extra groups of the assembled heavenly host, while he made record of the first instance on Urantia and the last, where a mortal creature had been resurrected in the likeness of the physical body of death. Lazarus could hardly comprehend what had occurred. He knew he had been very sick, but he could only recall that he had fallen asleep and had been awakened. He was never able to tell anything about these 4 days in the tomb because he was wholly unconscious. Time is non-existent to those who sleep the sleep of death. Though many believed in Jesus as a result of this mighty work, others only hardened their hearts the more to reject him. By noon the next day, this story had spread over all Jerusalem. Scores of men and women went to Bethany to look upon Lazarus and talk with him, and the alarmed and disconcerted Pharisees hastily called a meeting of the Sanhedrin that they might determine what should be done about these new developments. 5. What became of Lazarus? Lazarus remained at the Bethany home, being the center of great interest to many sincere believers and to numerous curious individuals, until the week of the crucifixion of Jesus, when he received warning that the Sanhedrin had decreed his death. the rulers of the Jews were determined to put a stop to the further spread of the teachings of Jesus, and they well judged that it would be useless to put Jesus to death if they permitted Lazarus, who represented the very peak of his wonder-working, to live and bear testimony to the fact that Jesus had raised him from the dead. Already had Lazarus suffered bitter persecution from them. And so Lazarus took hasty leave of his sisters at Bethany, fleeing down through Jericho and across the Jordan, never permitting himself to rest long until he had reached Philadelphia. Lazarus knew Abner well, and here he felt safe from the murderous intrigues of the wicked Sanhedrin. Soon after this, Martha and Mary disposed of their lands at Bethany and joined their brother in Perea. Meantime, Lazarus had become the treasurer of the church at Philadelphia. He became a strong supporter of Abner in his controversy with Paul and the Jerusalem church, and ultimately died, when 67 years old, of the same sickness that carried him off when he was a younger man at Bethany.
So, as you can see, the New Testament tells a tremendous story. And the Urantia Papers fill out and expand that story, giving names and dates, and just filling it in a whole lot more. That brings us to the conclusion of the investigation into the miracles of Jesus and the debate about the miracles, as we discussed it in our earlier episodes. And now I hope you will join us as we move on to the parables. The parables of Jesus, some of the greatest stories ever told, some of the best metaphors ever used to describe the spiritual reality of the universe. We'd like to thank the Cosmic Citizen and the Urantia Book Fellowship. We'd like to thank the Story of Jesus from the Bible Heritage Foundation for letting us use that story. And we'd like to thank you for participating and being here and sharing this with your friends. Join us next week as we begin the investigation into the parables of Jesus. Thank you. See you then.